With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
You're listening to the Fact Hunter Radio Network.
You're listening to the Fact Hunter Radio Network. Here is your host, George Hobbs.
Welcome back, everybody. This is 9/11, the planned demolition and why it still matters, part number three. And when we left off last time, we were talking about in late 1996, just as Lockheed was subcontracting the Port Authority work to ease it, NSEC added two new directors. And again, this was Raymond List of Kaiser Engineers and Terrence McAuliffe, who in 2001 would become chairman of the DNC. And we've talked about this guy before. This guy was the governor from Virginia. He was on Bill Clinton's reelection campaign in 96. And as we just stated, chairman of the DNC, in bed with the Clintons is obviously a bad sign. He was the guy in Virginia who said parents had no business of what's going on in the school, and it cost him because Glenn Youngkin came in and he took him out. He lost his governorship due for it. So there you go. This guy is not a good dude, right? Now, McAuliffe had been involved in even more suspicious dealings before. He was linked to Teamster-related corruption. And when the DNC national finance chairman, he made a $1.35 million gift to the Clintons, which later became a scandal. All these people are just terrible pieces of crap. McAuliffe was also involved in a lawsuit regarding Laurel Space, which is a company investigated for collaborating with and giving secrets to the Chinese for their satellite and intercontinental ballistic missile programs. And we know a lot of the folks on the left, you know, I don't like to play the left-right paradigm game, but a lot of folks on the left were in bed with China over the last 20 years. And a lot of that has come to light in just recent months and years as well. In another interesting coincidence, this potential national security breach also involved James Abrahams Hughes Aircraft through its subsidiary Hughes Electronics. Now, Prescott Bush Jr. was working with Hughes to secure satellite deals with China. Now, the charges against McAuliffe and the Laurel Space scandal were that he agreed to participate in this scheme to sell seats on the taxpayer-financed foreign trade missions and other government services in exchange for campaign contributions to the DNC, and played a central role in selecting trade mission participants and, on information and belief, securing other favorable treatment from the Clinton administration for defendant Laurel. Now, it was also reported that prominently figured among those selected for participating in the high-profile Commerce Department trade mission to China was defendant Schwartz, who would go on to become the single largest contributor to the DNC. Bernard Schwartz was the billionaire CEO of Laurel and Globalstar. Now, the CEOs of Hughes, Laurel, and Lockheed Martin co-wrote a letter to President Clinton back in October of 1995, asking the president to transfer all responsibility for commercial satellite export licensing to the Commerce Department. And if you look recently, all the Secretary of Commerce's, they have very close relationships to the Rothschilds. Now, all three companies later paid enormous fines for illegal exports of advanced missile technology to China, and Hughes himself was charged with 123 counts of national security violations. But in 1996, Clinton did move oversight of the satellite exports to the Department of Commerce and three CEOs, including Augustin and Schwartz, and he even thanked him publicly. Now, Lockheed Martin then bought the most of Laurel in April of 1996 for $9.1 billion. In reverse, that's 19. There's your number 19. Schwartz, whose company had been close to bankruptcy, was much richer for it. And today, PNAC co-founder Francis Fukuyama is the Bernard L. Schwartz Professor of International Political Economy at the Jesuit-run Johns Hopkins University. Now, McAuliffe was linked to another company that was mired in scandal, Global Crossing. It was reported that McAuliffe purchased $100,000 in Global Crossing stock before the company went public and cashed out several years later for $18 million. Richard Perle was a lobbyist for Global Crossing, which was a partner in several deals with the Chinese company Hutchison Wampau, called an arm of the PLA, that's the People's Liberation Army. Now, Li Ka-shing was the Chinese billionaire owner of Hutchison, as well as Chung Kong Holdings. Li has invested in firms owned by Winston Partners and has also employed Winston co-founder Marvin Bush's brother, Neil Bush, as a consultant. Between his DNC role and his later job as a campaign chairman for Hillary Clinton's presidential run, McAuliffe worked for vice chairman of Carrot Instruments. Now, McAuliffe was hired at Carrot by Alan Quasha, who once, listen to this, bailed out George W. Bush's failing oil company in 1986, folding Bush into his company, Harkin Energy, thus setting him on the path to a lucrative and high-profile position as an owner of the Texas Rangers baseball team, and then, of course, the presidency. So you see these people get put in bad spots, just like Trump. He was bailed out in the late 80s by the Rothschilds. And you've got the Bushes, right, being bailed out by these people. So they are owed. Now, this Alan Quasha character had owned Carrot since 2003. But you see, he was previously known for his leadership of Harkin Energy and thereby his connection to the many suspicious organizations related to Harkin, including BCCI. Now, at Carrot and Harkin, Quasha had a partner named Hassan Namaz. Namazi. There you go. An investor in Harkin and the founder of the Iranian-American PAC, Namazi was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations at the Brookings Institution and was also associated with RAND. In any case, NSEC International and its leaders should have been investigated for possible security breaches at the World Trade Center. The management structure at NSEC, including its arms dealer and founder Charles Finkel and its corrupt director Terry McAuliffe, should have led the 9/11 Commission and NIST to consider the problems that might have resulted from this company having rebuilt the access systems for the World Trade Center basement levels. Now, in addition to that, the fact that Lockheed Martin had subcontracted the Port Authority and their work to NSEC was one indicator that these companies might have benefited from the attacks. And anytime there's an event like this, you have to look and ask the question, who benefits? And not all the time, but in many cases, that will point you in the right direction. Okay. Now, having recently changed its names from Burns and Rowe Securicom in October of 1992, Securicom Incorporated positioned itself as a firm offering, quote, large-scale security and facility management for business and government. Now, the company first began doing work at the World Trade Center in 1993 following the bombing. So again, many people profited from the bombing in 1993, and that's something that we need to touch on as well. Now, it won a larger contract in 96, and a year later was forced to change its name again to Stratasec as a result of a lawsuit over trademark infringement. Now, the court found a deliberate effort by Securicom to financial bury the plaintiff Rob Liebengood and take everything he had by filing a barrage of frivolous arguments in multiple jurisdictions. That's what these big corporations always try to do when they get into a tussle with the little man. They try to drag it out in court and break them financially, so they just tap out. Now, this name change incident seems to be clear evidence of corruption, but where possible, we're just going to continue to use the company's names as Securicom, okay? Now, other projects that Securicom was working on in 97 were for Amtrak, Xerox, and a joint venture agreement with Ahmad N. Al-Banali Sons and Company, which is a large Saudi Arabian engineering and construction company, to develop and conduct business in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Securicom also had contracts to provide security services for several facilities other than the World Trade Center that there were key to the 9/11 attacks, including United Airlines, Dulles Airport, and that's, of course, where American Air 77 took off that day. Now, another client was Los Alamos National Laboratory, where scientists were working on the development of namothermite, and again, a type of explosive material that has since been discovered in the World Trade Center dust. Quote, when Securicom went public on September 11th, 1997, you can't make this stuff up, its prospectus for the IPO prominently featured photographs of its clients, the World Trade Center and Dulles Airport, with a client list that included United Airlines and Los Alamos National Laboratories. Now, perhaps as a result, Marsh and McLennan's subsidiary Putnam became one of Securicom's early investors. Now, Securicom had a small board of directors that included James Abrahamson of the White House Commission on Aviation Security, and then, of course, Marvin Bush, the brother of George W. Bush, and Wirt Walker III, say that three times fast, Wirt Walker III, who was a cousin of the Bush brothers. Other directors included Charles Archer, former assistant director in charge of the FBI's Criminal Justice Information Services Division, who had been recently promoted by the one and only Louis Free. Other Securicom director was Youssef Saud al-Sabah, a member of the Kuwaiti royal family, and yes, relative of Nayera al-Sabah, who gave false testimony in 1990 in front of Congress, and that emotional testimony of those Iraqi soldiers snatching babies out of the incubators and throwing them onto the ground. It was just another lie that kicked off Operation Desert Storm. It was a member of the Kuwaiti royal family, again, that critical testimony. It was the House, and it was called the Human Rights Caucus. So these family connections are just deplorable. Now, Youssef Saud al-Sabah was also chairman of the Kuwaiti American Corporation, QAM, which between 93 and 99 held a controlling share of Securicom. Now, this was an unusual arrangement, according to experts in the field, in that security services for sensitive U.S. facilities were not typically managed by foreign-owned companies. The fact that QAM owned Securicom suggested, according to Wayne Black, who was the head of a Florida-based security firm, that, quote, somebody knew somebody. Black also noted that when a company had a security contract, you know the inner workings of everything. And if another company is linked to the security company, then what's on your computer is on their computer. Now, the other owners of Securicom were Walker and an entity controlled by Walker and al-Sabah called Special Situation Involvement Holdings. Now, SSIH was said to form a group with QAM, and the group owned several other companies, including Commander Aircraft and Aviation General. Securicom director and retired Air Force General James Abrahamson was a former NASA administrator. and a former director of Reagan's Space Defense Initiative. As director of the SDI, which means he's a Freemason, from 1984 to 1989, he worked closely with the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, Frank Gaffney, and Assistant Secretary of Defense, Richard Perle, both of whom, again, were signatories on the PNAC documents. As a civilian, Abrahamson was president of Hughes Aircraft and a director of Turkey's Global Group. He became a director of Securicom in December of 1997. Although the availability of explosives was established during the review of the World Trade Center tenants, it must be noted that NASA uses explosives extensively in the launching of spacecraft and has done so for 50 years. According to this today, there are more than 250 strategically placed and precisely timed explosive devices that detonate on the space shuttle each time the vehicle flies. And again, Lockheed Martin is a major NASA supplier in that regard. Oh, by the way, NASA also uses thermite technology for space separation explosives and for initiators. And as with the improvised explosive devices that, you know, took a lot of the lives in the Middle East in both Iraq and Afghanistan, these IEDs, right? So there's really not a need for extensive wiring to detonate them. Now, Abrahamson was president of Hughes Aircraft from 89 to 92 when Prescott Bush Jr. was helping Hughes lobby his brother, the U.S. president, to lift sanctions on the Chinese government. Now, Abrahamson now serves on the board of GOI, which is the people who spy on us from above. He also co-founded a company called Crescent Investment Management with Mansoor Ejaz. So his partner, Mansoor Ejaz, is the CEO of Crescent. And the board of advisors included Maurice Sonnenberg, and former CIA director and another PNAC signatory, James Woolsey. Now, Ejaz is a rare individual in that he claimed to have the ability to persuade several governments to extradite Osama bin Laden, which we really know his name was Colonel Tim Osman, a CIA asset. Now, after meetings with Clinton and Sandy Berger, Ejaz says that he could not convince them to work the extradition. Additionally, Ejaz introduced the journalist Daniel Pearl, by the way of a personal letter, to those in Pakistan who are believed to have been the ones involved in his death. Ejaz went on to be a Fox News correspondent and was a strong promoter of false claims leading up to the Iraq war. So just another propagandist. You know, he was all about the weapons of mass destructions and the close ties between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. So just another person who was responsible for the deaths of, you know, millions of, you know, hundreds of thousands, million, whatever the number is, okay? Now, Crescent's Maurice Sonnenberg was the vice chairman of L. Paul Bremer's National Commission on Terrorism, where, by the way, Brian Jenkins was an advisor. Now, Sonnenberg was also a member of President Clinton's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board from 93 to 95 with Stephen Friedman of Marsh & McLennan. All right, at the same time, Sonnenberg was also a member of the U.S. Commission on Reducing and Protecting Government Secrecy with Lee Hamilton and John Deutsch, who replaced James Woolsey as director of the CIA in 1995. Now, Marvin Bush was the director of Securicom from 1993 to 2000. Bush was hired as part of a new management team when Securicom separated from Burns & Rowe. It was just at that time that the Port Authority and Kroll began planning for the extensive rebuilding of the security systems at the Trade Center complex. As his stint with Securicom ended, Marvin Bush became a principal in the company HCC Insurance, one of the insurance carriers for the World Trade Center. Now, Bush was also a director of Kirko, an oil company in Houston. Bush was the co-founder of Winston Partners in 93, which is a company that benefited greatly from the war on terror. In 2000, Winston Partners invested heavily in a defense contractor called AMSEC that was 55% owned by SAIC. It has been noted that SAIC was not only the largest NGO contributor to the NIST report, it was also a company that had expertise in nanothermite technology. So the SAIC was involved in the investigations of the 93 bombing, boasting that, quote, after the 93 World Trade Center bombing, our blast analysis produced tangible results that helped identify those responsible. As a company that sells expertise about weapons, about homeland security, surveillance, computer systems, and information dominance, and information warfare, and has been awarded more individual government contracts than any other private company in America. War pays, folks. SAIC has been paid huge sums to rebuild the NSA and the FBI systems that supposedly failed before 9/11. John Deutsch left SAIC to become Deputy Secretary of Defense in 1994. Now, Michael Braham, who took over CEO as AMSEC in 2003, was previously Senior Vice President Marsh Crisis Consulting, where his boss was J. Paul Bremer. When Marvin Bush joined its board in 2000, AMSEC's revenues were at about $100 million. Just 7 years later, its annual revenues had skyrocketed to $500 million. Barry McDaniel became the COO of Securicom beginning in May of 1998. McDaniel had worked for the U.S. government from 1970 to 1987, ultimately as Deputy Director of Readiness for the United States Army Material Command, AMC. Located at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, AMC is a primary provider of technology and equipment, and that includes explosive ordnance to U.S. Army personnel. Between 89 and 98, he was with BDM International as the Vice President of Material Distribution and Management Systems. BDM was a supplier of computer systems to the defense industry and had developed the electronic filing system for the Securities and Exchange Commission. After 9/11, Barry McDaniel, who was then CEO of Securicom, was asked whether the FBI or other agents had questioned him or others at the company about their security work related to 9/11. His answer, no, the FBI did. However, briefly consider investigating Securicom for possible inside trading related to 9/11 due to an SEC referral of suspicious accounts. But since the people involved were considered to not have any ties to terrorism or other negative information, the investigation was not pursued. Now let's talk about Silverstein Properties. Larry Silverstein owned Building 7, known as the Solomon Brothers Building. And in May 2001, he also finalized a deal for a 99-year lease of the World Trade Center complex and took over operations of 1, 2, 4, and 5 from the Port Authority. His partners in the deal were retail operator Westfield America and real estate investor Lloyd Goldman. Now, to finance this deal, Silverstein borrowed $726 million from GMAC Commercial Mortgage, which is a unit of General Motors. These slimeballs never, ever use their own money. These parasites, they never do. GMAC in turn converted the loan into securities, which sold it to investors like pension funds. Going back to our friend Alan Reese of the Port Authority, had been working on a three-month transition plan with a team including Silverstein Properties in the weeks prior to 9/11. Just before the attacks, the Silverstein Group had asked Reese to let it more fully operate all systems from safety systems to tenant relations. Silverstein had hired someone to run the World Trade Center complex for him. This was Jeffrey Wharton, who came to Silverstein Properties from Tishman Speyer, one of the city's biggest office landlords. Wharton was in charge of the buildings when they were destroyed and stayed with Silverstein for only 1 year after that. Wharton had been in the North Tower at the Windows on the World restaurant, where he had been at breakfast every single day, and was said to be on the last elevator to descend at 8:44 a.m. He greeted and left behind the Newport Authority executive director, Neil Levin, who was there waiting for someone, although he had not seen there before. Shortly thereafter, it was Jeff Wharton that first told Larry Silverstein about the attacks. But Silverstein watched it all play out on television. Although Silverstein was said to be distressed by the loss of four of his employees, at the same time, in a display of absolute shrewdness, Silverstein was already delving into the complex legal strategies by the next morning. Of course, he tried to claim those as separate terrorist attacks because two different planes hit. Just a evil, parasitic person. Wharton was a friend of Jerome Hauer, and through Hauer, Silverstein and Wharton met and hired an FBI agent named John O'Neill to run his security. It was reported that O'Neill started out as an FBI support employee and worked his way up to titles such as Assistant Special Agent in Charge and Section Chief in Charge of the Counterterrorism Division. In his 31-year career with the FBI, John O'Neill investigated nearly every terrorist attack ever attributed to Al-Qaeda, many of those under the direction and close supervision of FBI Director Louis Free. Quote, O'Neill had been a key part of the investigation of the World Trade Center bombing in 1993 and the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998, and of course, the attack on the USS Cole in Yemen. O'Neill was known to dress like a gangster and to fraternize with gangsters themselves. He was also dating several women at the same time and was lying to all of them. A few weeks before 9/11, O'Neill got serious about returning to his Catholic faith and started going to Mass every day. He repeatedly told people that he felt something was going to happen. On his second day at the World Trade Center office on the 34th floor, O'Neill was killed when the attacks occurred, although it might have not been immediate. It was reported that O'Neill escaped the building but actually went back in to help others. Of course, as you know, in 2007, Larry Silverstein was awarded a $4.55 billion settlement in insurance payouts for the destruction of the World Trade Center as a result of the largest insurance claim ever made. So now we're going to slide into the Giuliani, Tchaikovsky, and the BCCI investigation. The terrorist financing bank BCCI was being investigated by U.S. authorities as early as 1983 in an effort that began as an inquiry into drug money laundering. It was shortly thereafter that the British intelligence service MI6 linked BCCI with the funding of terrorism. Despite these facts, BCCI was allowed to gain control of several American financial institutions and was allowed to continue funding terrorism without being prosecuted for many years. Kroll's executive VP for operations, James Bucknum, worked for Rudy Giuliani as an AUSA SDNY in the late 1980s. Now, Giuliani was the attorney for the SDNY from 83 to 89 and was in charge of investigating BCCI. Now, it was reported that Giuliani received documents during this time about the secret bank accounts related to terrorist financing that were held by companies like Citibank, Barclays, Credit Lanais, and the Japanese company Nomura. What is less well reported is that when Giuliani left his job as AUSA SDNY to start a political career, he worked for a law firm called White & Case that actually represented BCCI. Now, with such detailed knowledge and experience with the terrorist funding bank BCCI, it's remarkable that Giuliani never mentioned terrorism as an issue in his campaign for the New York City mayorship in 1993. In fact, he barely mentioned the 93 World Trade Center bombing that occurred earlier that year, referring to it only once publicly. What's more, when he won the election and began looking for his first police commissioner, he never questioned the candidates about terrorism. For someone who had made a career both before 1993 and after 9/11 as a terrorist fighter, it was inexplicable that Giuliani would never talk about terrorism when running for his first elected office. Now, some have said that it was his relationship with BCCI and questions that might arise about that kept him quiet at the time. Actually, it's startling to review those who filled U.S. Justice Department positions with the SDNY around the same time in terms of their importance to the official myth of terrorism and the role of al-Qaeda. So this included Michael Chertoff, who later became Homeland Security Secretary. Also, you had Michael Mukasey, who was U.S. District Judge for SDNY from 1987 until he took it over from Alberto Gonzalez as Bush's Attorney General in 2006. Mukasey had presided over the trial of the 1993 World Trade Center bombers. Remember, Louis Free, who was Bandar Bush's attorney, was also part of the AUSA SDNY, and in 1991 was promoted by George H.W. Bush to be a U.S. District Court judge for the SDNY. 2 years later, Louis Free became the director of the FBI, and a position that he held until 2001. Additionally, Patrick Fitzgerald, who conducted the official investigation into the vengeful outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame in 2005, was also part of the AUSA SDNY, starting at the age of 27 years old. Fitzgerald appears to have been deliberately allowed the terrorist ringleader Ali Mohammed to remain free and unprosecuted over a period of years. In fact, author Peter Lance had suggested that Fitzgerald had evidence to implicate Mohammed in the 1998 Kenya embassy bombing before it even happened. But Fitzgerald deliberately allowed the bombing to occur. As early as 1994, FBI headquarters was systematically obstructing investigations into the financial backing of al-Qaeda, according to Special Agent Robert Wright. This obstruction allowed foreign-born terrorist operatives, such as the perpetrators of the September 11th attacks, to engage in illegal activities inside the United States. When Louis Free stepped down as FBI director in June of 2001, President Bush nominated Robert Mueller as his successor. Yes, that Robert Mueller of the Mueller Report in the Russia, Russia, Russia. Mueller was therefore the one who led the early investigations into the 9/11 attacks. But in the early 1990s, he was in charge of the Justice Department's criminal division and therefore ran the overall investigations into the BCCI. Now, also involved in the BCCI investigation was the Assistant District Attorney of New York County, Michael Cherkasky, who worked in the same job that Jules Krull had worked during the late 60s and early 70s. From 1990 to 1993, Cherkasky was the chief investigations for that office and was therefore in charge of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing investigation as well. Cherkasky later became an employee of Krull during the time the company developed the plan for security at the World Trade Center, 94 to 97, and then he became president and CEO of Krull while that plan was still being implemented from 97 to 2001. And ultimately, he was the company's CEO from 2001 to 2004. Now, Cherkasky's involvement in the BCCI investigation began in the spring of 1989 when Jack Blum, who had been the chief counsel to the U.S. Senate subcommittee investigation concerning drugs, law enforcement, and foreign policy, went to New York City to meet with the staff at the New York County's DA's office. At the time, Blum brought information he had about criminal activity involving BCCI. The investigation was originally about laundering drug money, but Blum and his colleagues were discovering the extent of criminality in which BCCI was engaged. When Jack Blum provided his revelatory information about BCCI, Cherkasky was not only skeptical of Blum, but he expressed it clearly. Cherkasky said that Blum was proposing that, quote, the entire third world, was involved, and that they had bought and sold entire governments and maybe even some United States officials. It was a fascinating tale. This guy was telling us the entire world was corrupt. Eventually, the world found out that Blum was right. By the fall of 1990, the New York County DA's office could not ignore the evidence of the massive fraud at BCCI, as described through audits by Pricewaterhouse in the United Kingdom. This evidence compelled the DA to investigate formally, and as a result, in July of 1991, more than 2 years after Blum's visit, the New York District Attorney indicted BCCI. The indictment has since been called warmed over information from an investigation that had ended nearly 2 years before. Unfortunately for all of us, although BCCI was closed, the money for terrorist funding got away. So, several facts are clear from this review of the companies and the people responsible for revamping the security systems from the World Trade Center buildings, and of course, securing New York City on September the 11th, 2001. One is that many of the people involved were deceptive and corrupt and appeared to have benefited from the attacks. Another is that many of them were connected to each other and to the investigations into previous acts of terrorism and the terrorist financing bank, BCCI. Yet another striking similarity among these organizations is that they all did major work for the Saudi Arabian government or the royal family of Kuwait. Finally, the history of some of those involved, like Terry McAuliffe, shows a level of greed and corruption that has overshadowed all preconceptions about United States politics. The Port Authority occupied a good deal of space in the towers and contributed to the false Trade Center report from the NIST. Some of its commissioners were linked to BCCI, and its World Trade Center director appeared to be intentionally deceptive after the attacks. Others, like Silverstein Property Security Manager John O'Neill and FBI Director Louis Free, were the leading experts on Al-Qaeda. The management of Kroll created the World Trade Center security plan, created authoritative reports that promoted a fear of terrorism, had expert knowledge of BCCI, and were intimately linked to the impact zone tenant Marsh and McLennan. AIG was one of the owners of Kroll, and as of 1993, along with Marsh, Lockheed Martin, and L3 Communications, which was the defense contractor successor to Loral Corporation, was a company whose stock was flagged by the SEC after 9/11 in relation to SEC trading, or insider trading, excuse me. Now, less than a month after the attacks, AIG's Chairman Greenberg said, quote, "The opportunities for us are enormous. And it's just not in the United States, but rates are rising throughout the world. So our business looks quite good going forward." Again, a lot of people made a hell of a lot of money off of 9/11. And it's clear that some management representatives at the primary World Trade Center security companies also benefited from the war on terror. Look, just off the top of your head and what we talked about today, you had Abrahamson, you had McAuliffe, Marvin Bush, Larry Silverstein, on and on and on. Silverstein had a huge windfall. All four of the primary contractors that were involved in rebuilding the security systems for the World Trade Center had done significant business with the Saudis. Electronic Systems Associates parent, SNH, designed King Saud University, and EJ Electric worked for Saudi Arabian Airlines. Then you had ENSEC. They were owned by a former arms dealer to the Saudis and Securicom, owned by a member of the Kuwaiti royal family that was in a partnership with Ahmad N. al-Banali and Sons Company, which is the large Saudi Arabian construction company. Of course, 15 of the 19 alleged hijackers were where? Even if you buy this official story that it was 19 hijackers, where did they say they were from? Saudi Arabia. So, of course, Saudi had a hand in this. Saudi, Kuwait, the Mossad, and the CIA, and many of the people like the Bushes and the people we just mentioned, the McAuliffes, the Abrahamsons, and, of course, the Silversteins. These leaders of New York City and New York County, who were also the primary players on 9/11 and in the ensuing investigations, were the investigators of the BCCI and the 1993 World Trade Center bombing in the late 80s and early 90s. All of them seemed to benefit from the 9/11 attacks. Louis Freeh started a homeland security business and began representing the Saudis. Chikaski went on to become the CEO of Marsh after it bought Kroll and helped it avoid prosecution for fraud. Others, like Giuliani, became national heroes for the response to 9/11. Who can forget those images, right? So could those involved in the BCCI investigation in New York, many whom played a large role in the events leading up to, during, and after the 9/11 attacks, somehow have used the information they learned about BCCI to facilitate the attacks and then benefit from them? That is treason at the highest level that we've ever seen in this world. If so, they might have had to eliminate certain individuals who knew too much. Could the security firms and certain tenant companies have conspired to prepare the Twin Towers for demolition well in advance of the attacks? It's quite plausible. In fact, a number of these people, including Giuliani, Cherkasky, Freeh, Mueller, Bremer, and Hauer, were charged and indicted by Citizens Grand Jury for the crimes of 9/11. Further investigations, subpoena power, trials, and crimes against humanity and treason should be carried out against these people. And we'll follow up part three. I'm not sure if I'm going to get to it today, folks, but I'll try to have it out by Monday or Tuesday. The part three in this tremendous series, you're going to examine the organizations and people who were involved cleaning up Ground Zero, which was one of the biggest crime cover-up investigate, you know, covering up this crime on a massive scale that you have never seen before. And again, our thanks to 911truth.org for this tremendous, tremendous piece of work by Kevin Ryan from almost 13 years ago, my friends. Thanks again for tuning in to The Fact Hunter. Appreciate all your support. Emails, thefacthunter@mail.com. Don't forget, for the book drawing, send us an email to thefacthunter@mail.com. 500K in the subject, name and where you're from in the body. God bless each and every one of you. And until next time, keep your heads on a swivel. We will see ya.
You're listening to the Fact Hunter Radio Network.
Just the facts, ma'am.